Breeze, who is visiting from Chicago and visits regularly from Chicago. So the Chabad Rav, we will be discussing women's issues. I want to write on feminism, but I was didn't want to get anything politically incorrect. So women's issues and halacha. Thank you.
Okay. Well, this is a very hot topic. It's one which is occupying the attention of many in the community right now, and one has to be very, very careful about what they say when speaking about this subject. I was going to say, without thinking twice about the innuendo, that it's a broad topic, then I realized that who knows how people would take that. So it's something which I think is incumbent upon us to be able to address, and with sensitivity and with compassion and with integrity. And primarily, we have to start by looking at all of the halakhic, and what halakhic framework in terms of addressing all of the controversies that are swirling around regarding what are appropriate leadership roles for women, what are the definitions of srara, of a type of a role that would be prohibited or limited according to halakha when it comes to women, and what are the parameters and dimensions of a permissible Talmud Torah, of what women can be taught, what women can learn, and the types of leadership that can be exercised in the modern age when the world around us seems to have changed in a great measure. Years and years ago, if one looked at the workforce, it was primarily dominated by men. The leaders of the businesses and corporations were primarily men. And in the general workforce, much has changed significantly. Women have assumed more and more public roles. They've assumed more and more leadership roles. And even in terms of women's secular education, they are just as likely to receive advanced degrees in all kinds of other fields. So the question becomes, how does this affect our Torah climate? How does it affect our Torah community? So the one thing that I would just maybe also add as a preliminary note is that this does not need to be a contentious discussion. This is one which is very natural and normal for us to explore. It's a discussion that is not off limits in terms of what the Torah allows us to think about. And in fact, it is one where I believe that there is much that we can learn from halakhic precedent, from the halakhic sources, and one which is inclusive in nature. It's not men versus women, it's not women versus men, it's the Torah community trying to grapple with an issue which is important to us and which we want to approach it with Yiras Shamayim, and we want to approach it with halakhic integrity. First of all, this idea of srara that the Rambam writes in Hilchos Sanhedrin, Hilchos Malachim, excuse me, the Rambam writes in Perek Aleph Halacha Hey, that a woman is not allowed to be a malka. That we learn from the Sivrei based on the pasuk in Shoftim, Som Tasim Alecha Melech Melech Velo Malka, and the Rambam adds V'chein Kol Mesima Shebiyisrael, and so to any position of leadership in the Jewish community is off limits to women. Now this drasha V'chein Kol Mesima Shebiyisrael is not found in the classical versions of the Sivrei. You'll find it in Midrash Tanayim in later Midrashim, but it was such an obscure source that Rav Moshe Feinstein and the Igros Moshe, Yerodea, Chelik Beis, Simen Mem Dalet, Simen Mem Hei, goes so far as to say that the Rambam may have really derived it on his own, since there's a limud that when it comes to Geirin, that since the Pasuk speaks about Bekara Bachecha, that the same Pasuk that excludes a woman from being a Malka says that all of her positions have to be some Fasim Alecha, Bekara Bachecha, it has to be from the midst of your own brethren, those who are born as Jews, that all Sraros, the Medrash learns from here, that all Sraros, all positions of authority are off limits to a ger, and so too the Rambam derived that by the same token, the exclusion of, just as the exclusion of Melech applies to all positions when it comes to a ger, so too it applies to all positions when it comes to an Isha. But Rav Moshe points out that if you look in the Sefer Achinuch did not seem to have this tradition. Sefer Achinuch and Mitzvot Tavtzai Zayin, Mitzvot Tavtzai Riches, when mentioning the exclusion of a woman from being a Malka, seems to limit the exclusion only to the appointment of being a queen, but not to anything else. There are two proofs from the Sefer Achinuch. One proof is from Mitzvot Tavtzai Zayin, where the Sefer Achinuch subsequently talks about all other positions of Malkus that are passed down in Yerusha, but when the Sefer Achinuch speaks about the exclusion of an Isha from being a Malka, does not extend that to all other positions. And the second proof is in Mitzvot Tavtzai Riches, where Sefer Achinuch speaks about the exclusion of a Ger from being a Melech and explicitly extends that to all other positions of Srara, and yet in the previous mitzvah, when the Chinuch brought the exclusion with respect to a woman, he did not extend it to other positions of Srara. And Rav Moshe Feinstein spends a lot of time demonstrating that there are other Rishonim, even most of the Rishonim, who he believes are of the same mindset of the as the Sefer Achinuch, that Srara is only off limits to a ger, but not to a woman, with the exception of being a Malka. There was one opinion going back during the time of the election controversy in Eretz Yisrael, the question of whether women should be allowed to vote. There were many of the poskim who registered different opinions. They're summarized by the Sri Deish that there were three different camps. There was one camp that said that women couldn't be elected and they couldn't vote, one camp that said they can vote but they can't be elected, and the third camp that said, well, they can both be elected and they can vote, and which is, of course, all different from the approach that existed in the United States before Susan B. Anthony came along, which was that women could be elected but they couldn't vote. That was the Torah way is always differed from the ways of the world around us, so that was that fourth opinion didn't seem to be expressed. However, in the course of that controversy, there was a Persian Soren who came along and wanted to argue that the exclusion of Melech v'lo Malka didn't mean a woman couldn't be the queen, leader of the people. It meant that a king was not obligated to be married to a queen. And he said, because a woman who serves as a queen is really a moleches, she's not called a malka, the exclusion is melech v'lo malka. But others pointed out, Sheres Yisrael and other authorities pointed out that this was essentially gobbledygook, because if you look in Tanakh, you'll find the word malka referring to people who served as actual queens, like Malka Sheva. And that it's really just a grammatical difference. It's in the active verb of a woman who is expressing herself as queen is moleches. If we're referring to the title, it's Malka. Everybody, certainly the Rambam and all of the Rishonim, understood the exclusion of Melech v'lo Malka to mean very clearly that a woman, at the very least, can't serve as queen. The question is how far we would extend that principle. So Rav Moshe spoke about the following situation of a woman who had been a mashgicha Well, her husband had been a mashgiach, and she kind of worked together with him, but he was the mashgiach, and they made a parnasa, her husband being the mashgiach, and then he passed away, and she wanted to be able to assume that position so that she could continue to have a parnasa. But the question was whether serving as a mashgiach was a position of sarara or not. Mm-hmm. And Rav Moshe, very interestingly, concluded that being a mashgiach is a position of sarara. You wouldn't necessarily think that this is the most grandiose and glorious position, but Rav Moshe said it's not dependent necessarily on the glory of the position. It's dependent upon whether there is the ability to boss around the balei habatim. Since the mashgiach can tell the owners of the food establishments and the like what they're allowed to serve and what they're not allowed to serve, so that therefore constitutes a position of a sarara, and according to the Rambam, it would be off limits from a woman. However, Rav Moshe says that there are two considerations that one would have to apply in this type of situation. One is the realization that many Rishonim, such as the Sefer HaChinuch, don't agree with the Rambam's expansion of the Issur of Sarara, and therefore he says in a Tzach Gadol situation like this, there might be room to be lenient to allow the woman to be in that position. And number two, Rav Moshe says that in the event that you have a situation like this, where there really is a very strong, compelling reason to enable the woman to be in the job, then the best thing is to try to incorporate the Shita Sarambam into the final solution. He says we can't disregard the Rambam, but we can figure out creative ways in order to accommodate the Shita, because it is a valid Shita according to the Halakha, and it is part of our Mesorah. So Rav Moshe says that the ideal solution would be to find a Rav, to find a rabbinic figure who would serve as the supervisor of this woman, that she would technically report to this supervisor, and the woman would then have all the responsibilities of the position, but because there would be a Rav who would be serving as the supervisor, it would not be considered as sarara, and therefore even the Shita Sarambam could be accommodated. And then after Rav Moshe issued this tshuva, he was roundly criticized by the editor of the journal HaMa'or, who wrote a letter to Rav Moshe saying that since Rav Moshe had, so to speak, opened up the floodgates by suggesting that there was room to compromise within the Rambam, this might lead to all kinds of horrible things happening, such as maybe the state of Israel would appoint a woman to be the prime minister or president, and who knows what else. And Rav Moshe said, well, first of all, the state of Israel never calls me with their shilas. secondly, he said that let's say there would be a concern of a woman being appointed to a position of leadership within a base Knesset, which is a more real concern, such as to be the president of the base Knesset. So he says that, of course, the leaders of the community would turn to their local Rav to make any such determination, and the local Rav would be mindful of the opinion of the Rambam, she'lo limnos isha, not to appoint a woman to such a position. Now, you could read that line in Rav Moshe one of two ways. Either that Rav Moshe was saying that since the Rambam is of this opinion, so any rabbinic figure would therefore know not to ever appoint a woman to such a position because of the Shita of the Rambam. Or Rav Moshe could be saying that any Rav would take into consideration the Shita of the Rambam, that according to the Rambam, it would not be appropriate to appoint a woman to that position, but then would have to consider all of the other exigencies of the situation, just like Rav Moshe did in the context of the Mashgicha. And Rav Moshe goes on to say something very, very interesting, which is echoed also in an article that I read on the, this is, you could find this on the website Halacha Yomis, that records rulings of Rav Avadya Yosef. I don't think it's published in any written form that I'm aware of by Rav Avadya Yosef. But Rav Moshe says that obviously, if you have a situation where there are only two qualified candidates for a position, and one of them is a position of sarara, a position of leadership, and one of them is a woman, and who is God-fearing and who is extremely observant in terms of Torah and mitzvot. And the other is a man, but he's an apikoros. He's a heretic, and he's somebody who is not Shomer Shabbos, and he's not Shomer Mitzvos. So he says it's obvious that, of course, we would appoint in such a case a woman over a man who is not a Yerei Shemayim and not Shomer Mitzvos, because then you have no other choice, and the halakha doesn't say to appoint somebody who is a kofir b'Torah over a woman if those are the only two candidates. And similarly, Rav Avadya Yosef says that when it comes to picking the Rosh HaMemshalah, even the Prime Minister of the State of Israel, if you had two candidates and one of them was a God-fearing woman and the other was a candidate who was a man who was heretical and was anti-Torah values, then of course it would be preferable to appoint the woman in such a situation. So that there is wiggle room within the halakha. And it's very interesting that this is a halakha where there is this allowance, as we see from Rav Moshe, as we see from some of the flexibility within the Shita of the Rambam, that there is a built-in flexibility. And we believe very strongly in the divine origins and plan of the way in which the Torah was given to us, that there was some sort of a built-in flexibility with respect to this issue that would enable us to navigate these difficult situations, with the goal always being that you want to create the result that is faithful to the halakhic framework and also furthers the purpose of bolstering Shmiras HaMitzvos and Yiras Shemayim within the community. Now, Rav Soloveitchik had a further nuance with respect to the issue of Sarara, which I suppose on some level also segues to the next consideration, which is the consideration of Sneas. Rav Moshe had pointed out that if you look in the Ramah at the very beginning of Shulchan Aruch Yoredeya, so there's a discussion about whether a woman can serve as a chetis, whether she can be a slaughterer of animals. So Miyikaradin, there's no reason why a woman couldn't be a shochet. That's how the Mechaber paskins. But the Ramah says our minhag is that women simply don't do it, that women simply haven't shechted. And the Shach points out, well, there's a critique to the Ramah's argument based on the fact that we don't see women shecht anymore, that lo ra'inu ein oraya, the fact that we haven't seen it done doesn't mean that it's usher. But then he says, no, maybe when it comes to a minhag, lo ra'inu really is a raya, that the fact that it's not done means that it really shouldn't be done. So Soloveitchik said, what's going on over here? So he pointed out that the nature of what it means to be a shochet has changed over the years. It used to be that people would just shecht the chickens in their backyard. Everybody would be their own shochet. But over the centuries, the position of the shochet changed to become a more public position, to become a position of minoy, of appointment, that every community would appoint a shochet. You go to like museums or community centers of old communities in America, and you see that there's a tremendous emphasis placed on who was the shochet of the community, sometimes even more than who was the rav of the community, because this is the person who really enabled everybody to eat. I mean, kemach ein Torah, you gotta eat. If you saw in Parshas B'Shalach, you know, the Jewish people has always valued its meat. So the shochet position became very much a position of minoy, and the rav said that when it comes to the Isser of Sarara that the Rambam speaks about for women, it's a more encompassing prohibition or restriction than just Sarara itself. The Rambam uses the lashon of kol mesimos shebi Yisrael. When he speaks about, for example, the limitation of Sarara on a gear, he speaks about Sarara. Of course, Sarara should be so. When he speaks about it in the context of a woman, he says kol mesimos shebi Yisrael. That it's not only a restriction upon an authority position. Being a shochet is not an authority position per se. There could be there's a rav who supervises the shochtim, but it's a minoy position. It's a public appointment. And any type of public appointment is included in the nature of the restriction for a woman. So the question is, why should that be? according to the Rav's logic, why would there be this differentiation? Where do you see in the pasuk, for example, that there would be a more expansive differentiation between a woman and what would be off limits for a ger who certainly could be a shochet? So it seems that this would be based on the next consideration, which is very much highlighted in the halachic discussions on this subject, and that's the discussion of tznius. That when it comes to everybody, we're supposed to conduct ourselves in a fashion of tznius. Rav Shechter has written articles about this, how HaKadosh Baruch Hu is described as kel mistater, and we're all supposed to emulate HaKadosh Baruch Hu, v'halachta v'drachav, but there's more of a responsibility, so to speak, upon the women to conduct themselves in a fashion of tznius, as is evident from the pasuk of Kol Kavud Bas Melech Penima, that it is considered to be a special honor, a special glory for Jewish women to conduct themselves with a modesty. This could sometimes be viewed as a little bit of a double-edged sword. There's a very curious Gemara in Erevin, which speaks about the klolos that Chava suffered, and one of the klolos is described as she's chavusha beveisa asurin, that she's like trapped in some sort of a jail. And Rashi says, how do we know that? Where do we see the nature of this klolos? So he says, yeah, because the pasuk says kol kavud bas melech penima. So that's a very striking and astonishing Rashi. But I think that the idea that is really conveyed by that Rashi is the very same idea that we often struggle with in the current age, which is sometimes it seems like a curse, that it is a responsibility that really bespeaks of a bracha, of a special glorified status, that the woman is the Akeres HaBayis, she's the one who builds the home, she has a private role of great responsibility, but sometimes that can appear, that can feel restricting. Sometimes it can feel constricting for women who are members of the community. But nonetheless, it's important to reckon with it because it's part of the Torah value system that we all have to limit ourselves to some degree. That's the idea of modesty. A man is not, even if he wants to daven for the amud, he's not supposed to run to the amud to grab it in order to be a shliach tzibur. If he's asked to daven for the amud, he's supposed to hesitate and say no at first. And the second time, he just kind of like begins to move his body a little bit. And only the third time stands up and goes and agrees to become a shliach tzibur. We're all supposed to act with hesitation when it comes to serving in public roles, and that responsibility is even greater for women. In fact, there are halakos. The Gemara in Yevamos and Dabayin Vav speaks about how there are halakos that are derived from this principle of Kol Kavud Bas Melech Penima, the halakha that only Ammoni men and Moabi men were prohibited from marrying within the Jewish nation upon conversion to Judaism. That was a restriction, a prohibition that was placed upon them, because they did not offer bread and water to the Jews when they were leaving Egypt. And the question, and the Gemara says, but this only applies to the men, the Ammoni, below Ammonis, but not the women. Moabi, below Moabis, not the women. That's how Boaz was able to marry Rusa Moabia, and why it is that David HaMelech is considered to be a legitimate king. Our whole monarchy, our whole dynasty in Judaism is dependent upon this halakha, is dependent upon this limud. So the Gemara says, but why are you letting off the women scot-free? Maybe the women should also be punished, because even though it's the derech hadvarim, that it's the way of men to go out and to offer food and water, they're the more public personalities, but maybe at the very least the women should have gone out and they should have provided for lechem and mayim to the women of the Jewish people, which would have been more in accordance with tznius, and nonetheless they didn't even do that. So the Gemara says, no, kol kavud bas melech penima. Even that is not something which could be mandated of women or expected of women, because there's a notion of kol kavud bas melech penima, and therefore the women are not culpable for not going out. And that's why we have the exception, the halakha, to allow the Moabite women and the Ammonite women to marry within the Jewish people if they should convert to Judaism. So we see that actual halakhos are derived from this limud, from this perspective, from this ideal of modesty. And therefore, that's something which translates into real halachic ramifications. And it's the same type of consideration that led to a very public and very memorable discussion decades ago regarding the very definition of Orthodox Judaism, where there was a shul that had a charter that said it had to be conducted according to Orthodox Judaism, and they wanted to do away with the mechitza. And there was one man, I think his name was Baruch Litwin, who made a very big deal that since the bylaws said that the shul has to be conducted according to Orthodox Judaism, that means that there have to be standards of tznius, which are preserved, which means that you absolutely have to have a mechitza that goes across the shul that separates between the men and the women. And this became a major campaign. It actually became a court case. You see, when rabbis can't have the final words, so then it just goes to the courts. So the courts decided, based on a lot of materials that were presented, that in fact this appears to be the rule of Orthodox Judaism. This is part of the definition of classical halacha, that standards of tznius have to be preserved, and Orthodox Judaism means that there has to be a mechitza in the shul. There was a collection of articles that were written by many, many Orthodox rabbis at the time across the spectrum of Orthodoxy, all explaining why there's a requirement for mechitza in the shul. It's called Sanctity of the Synagogue. So that was an issue that met with a lot of fanfare at the time in which this was being discussed. And nowadays we have different issues that meet with a lot of fanfare. So one of the suggestions that has been made is that maybe now it's time for Sanctity of the Synagogue Part 2, and that this next volume would discuss limitations and parameters and guidelines with respect to women's roles. It's not a bad idea, especially since it was my idea. However, it also has to be done the right way, in which it doesn't come across as a polemic, but it's one which is just a thoughtful discussion and exploration of these issues. But much is certainly revolves around the ideas of tznius, of time, place, and manner considerations. Now, along these lines, one of the major questions that arises with respect to different roles that are being suggested for women right now in the community is not only the question of does this role constitute Sraara, does it not constitute Sraara, but what about tznius considerations? So one of the big discussions is that which we mentioned before that Rav Moshe alludes to in passing, you could call it dicta, in his tshuva, in which he speaks about the relevance of the Rambam to the question of whether a woman could be a president of a synagogue. So there is a tradition, those who remember were at meetings with Rav Soloveitchik, so it is brought down, two of the writers on this subject who have written prolifically on these areas of discussion are Aryeh Frimer and Dov Frimer, two Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael. And in one of their articles, they speak about a conversation that took place between the executive director of the Rabbinical Council of America, Rabbi Binyamin Wolfish, and Rav Soloveitchik, in which Rabbi Wolfish asked Rav Soloveitchik, what does he think about women being president of a synagogue? And the Rav was against it, ostensibly because it constitutes a position of Sraara. Now, that's a question whether, objectively speaking, across the board, we would always define being president of a synagogue as Sraara. There's a whole recent debate about whether a ger, whether a convert who's not allowed to assume Sraara, whether a convert is allowed to be president of a synagogue. And there's an official policy of the National Council of Young Israel that a ger is not allowed to be president of a synagogue because they consider it to be Sraara, in which case, obviously, it would be Sraara for a woman as well. But this actually is not unanimously accepted. there is a tshuva by the Dov Aaron Brisman from the Beis Din of Philadelphia in his Sefer Shalmichova, these are all in the materials, by the way, in which he argues that being president of a synagogue, in many communities anyway, is not necessarily a sarara, because the president can't really take unilateral actions without the approval of the board of the synagogue, and often without the vote of members of the synagogues, and it's only for a limited term, and they can get rid of him. And for all of these reasons, he argues that being president of a synagogue is not necessarily a sroa. The one who disagreed with that notion was, who wrote a tshuva, anyway, disagreeing with that notion was Rav Aaron Felder Zichrona Levracha, who was also affiliated with the Beis Din of Philadelphia. And Rav Aaron Felder said that he just doesn't think Metzias quite. It's true. He thinks that from a Metzias perspective, being president of a synagogue does allow the president a certain amount of unilateral authority and decision-making ability, and therefore he said it's just impossible to argue that it's not really a svara. But you might argue as well that based on the approach that was taken by Rav Soloveitchik, which is recorded in his Chidushim on Yoredeya that were published by our own Rabbi Eliakim Konigsberg Shlita, that the Rav may have had a different concern with respect to the position of the presidency, and that's a concern that even if it wouldn't be a srara vis-a-vis a ger, it might be a minoy, it might be a position of public appointment, and therefore that might be the problem with respect to appointing a woman, and also that being president also requires very much a public image, a public role. Just think about how it's the president who often makes announcements during synagogue or whatever, which itself, if you had a woman crossing over, that would be a breakdown of the separation of the mechitza, would be a breakdown of tznius norms. It'd be very difficult for a woman to serve in that role without breaking down tznius norms. Now, in the event that a synagogue is set up in such a way in which there's more of a consultation type of executive leadership and the president doesn't have so much power, and there would be norms of sneers that could be presented, and it was the type of situation that fell into the other discussion of Rav Moshe, where there was nobody else who was more qualified, who had the same amount of Yiras Shamayim and Shmiras HaMitzvos, an investment in the future success of the shul from a Torah perspective. So then it's possible that it's something that Poskim can think about in the context of a given case. However, this would obviously require all of these different issues being taken betocha cheshbon. When dealing with tznius, sometimes making compromises in one case leads to a greater sense of confusion overall that could create a lack of uniformity in the practice of Klal Yisrael, which itself is potentially problematic. For example, the Gemara in Megillah talks about how, technically speaking, Hakol Olam the Minyan Shiva, that everybody can be called up for an aliyah, afilu isha, and even a woman. But a woman's not called up for an aliyah because of kavod tzibur. So when the Rambam codifies this halacha, the Rambam doesn't say, "Oh, Hakol Olam that technically a woman can get an aliyah, but we just don't do it because of kavod tzibur," which essentially, again, there are different ways of understanding kavod tzibur, but pashtus is that this is a tznius consideration. So the Rambam just says, isha lo tikra b'tzibur Torah b'nei kavod tzibur. It doesn't say, really, it would have been okay. And Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg argues that the Gemara is giving us a context for the halacha, but the Gemara is not saying that there are really two halachas. It's really okay, but sometimes it's not okay. The Gemara is saying it's not okay, but let's explain why it's not okay. The reason it's not okay is not because a woman has nothing to do with Torah. The reason it's not okay is because of the fact that there's a notion of communal tznius. There's a notion of what could be called Kedushas Beis HaKnesses. So for that reason, the Bach in Siman Nun Gimel, on the side of the Torah. So the Bach says that when we speak about kavod tzibur, it's not something which is waivable. It's not something where the tzibur can say, okay, well, we don't care about our kavod. Like there's a halacha that you can't have a long period of having the Torah having the Torah rolled in the tzibur. You're supposed to prepare the Torah ahead of time in terms of the place that it's supposed to be, which it's supposed to be up to, so you don't have to roll the Torah with tzibur. So he says, if a tzibur comes along and says, that's okay, every Shabbos we'll wait 10 minutes in order to roll the Torah to its proper place. We don't care about kavod. He says, they don't have the right to do that. Kavod at tzibur is something which is a communal responsibility to uphold. It cannot be waived by the tzibur. And not only that, but let's say he said that it would be waived by one tzibur, so then you would create agudot agudot. You would be creating an inconsistent type of a situation in which it would be Nasu Yisrael, agudot agudot, tzibur ze yimchov, tzibur ze lo yimchov. One tzibur is going to waive and one tzibur is not going to waive. So this is also a similar type of consideration. I don't know, it's been explicitly mentioned in recent discussions about this particular issue, but this is also something that has to be taken into account. If fundamentally this is Tznius concern, then if there are individual cases that could be exceptions, we have to worry about what type of a message it would make if we made individual exceptions. And then there will be cases where those exceptions would not be applicable, but members of the community might have a hard time distinguishing between when it's appropriate and when it's not, and when it's not appropriate. So now let's talk about another issue. Yes.
Can you argue that rolling the Torah maybe is more tirfa d'tzibura?
I'm sorry.
Can you argue that maybe rolling the Torah is more of a tirfa d'tzibura issue as opposed to kavod d'tzibura? Maybe they can be mevater on that.
I don't know. I give that as an example because the Bach just lumps them all together. So that was just one. He gives several examples of where we say there are things that you can't do because of kavod d'tzibura. But the fundamental notion is the kavod d'tzibura is something which is not necessarily the bialis of a particular tzibur, their ownership to decide to waive their kavod. It's something which we impose upon the tzibur that they are supposed to conduct themselves in a fashion of kavod, and in fact, in a fashion of self-respect and dignity and so forth. Now, another area which comes up quite a bit in these discussions, it was mentioned there were two articles published recently by Rav Schechter, so we can update the discussion, I guess, every single year, in volume Memhei of Beis Yitzchak. So there were two essays by Rav Schechter on issues that have arisen in the last couple of years regarding women's roles within the Jewish community. One article was about women wearing tefillin, where the Rama paskins very clearly that women don't wear tefillin because we have to maintain a certain type of sanctity, concentration, and so forth, and even men only wear tefillin in the bare minimal fashion. That's why we take off our tefillin early on Rosh Chodesh. We have an obligation. We must wear tefillin, but we don't wear tefillin all the time. Women don't have to wear tefillin, so therefore we don't even allow women to wear tefillin. But there was a movement to allow a woman who wanted to wear tefillin to wear tefillin. So Rabbi Schechter and others wrote about this and spoke about this. And the other was with the question of partnership minyanim, of women gathering and having prayer groups in which somehow there would be Kriya Satora and they try to do everything according to Allah, but it's not quite in the spirit of the halacha, as Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz points out. There's a lot of crossover with respect to the mechitza, things that are very, very problematic. But in addition to the things that are halakhically problematic, obviously our yeshiva does not accept the notion of either women wearing tefillin or partnership minyanim. So, but one of the themes, in addition to the technical halakhic problems that was articulated in both of those essays, is this theme of misorah, that there is a certain misorah as to what are our practices, what are the hallowed practices that we have in our tradition, and what's the process for exploring changes within our tradition. That there is the pasuk that Rav Schechter quotes that is from the davening in Uvalitziyam, Anizos Brisio Sam Uchir Sher Alechad Varaya Sher Samti Bepicha. There's the notion of the Udvarai, there are the technical letter of the law written halachos, and then there's the Ruchi Asher Alecha, there's the Ruach Adin, there's the Ruach Halacha, there's the spirit of the halacha, and to figure out when there is some fungibility or when it's appropriate to try to find the basis to come up with different models and so forth. So then it's extremely important to consult with the Gedolei Hador, with the leading poskim of the generation, in order to make sure that the things are done correctly. It's like the Chassam Sofer writes in Tshuva Berov Yoetz, said that we wouldn't dream of making even simple decisions in halacha if we're not absolutely sure without consulting with each other, and certainly if there are going to be changes that could create an upheaval in the community in terms of the way things are done, they require the input and they require the review and they require consultation and endorsement of the leading Gedolei HaPoskim, and that's not something which has been done in connection with these practices. So is it legitimate to have discussions if there are, for example, women who are very, very sincere and want to find different ways of being able to express and explore that sincerity, and they're going to try very hard to do it within the realm and the bounds of tznius and to respect the norms of halakha as reflected by the Shita Sarambam when it comes to the Sarara, and with a respect and reverence to the halakha? Yes, of course, but even the Benos Tzlachot, when they had a legitimate taina with respect to receiving a Yerusha when there were no sons in the family, and to argue that in such a case the daughter should receive the Yerusha, so they approached Moshe Ve'Aaron. They came into the Beis Medrash. They had the discussion where we allowed them to approach the Gedolei HaPoskim. Certainly we shouldn't prevent the access, but then that conversation took place, and they're described as Chachmanios. They were very, very wise women. They were wise in part because they had an understanding and they had a respect for the process of the Mesorah, and this is something which has always been part and parcel of any type of involvement with respect to changes, with respect to women and with respect to changes or any kinds of innovations that have been requested by women throughout the ages. When there was the formation of the Beis Yaakov movement, there had never been structured schooling for women in the Torah community. This was something that was brought to the table. The Gedolei Hador. It was brought to the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim, in his commentary, in his Likutei Halachos, his commentary to Masechta Sota, explains why it is that even though the Gemara, the Mishnah and Gemara over there, quote Rabbi Eliezer, Kol Melamed Bito Torah Ki Ilu Melamed Tiflos, somebody who teaches Torah to their daughter, it's as if he's taught her promiscuity. So there really wasn't a structured school system for women. So the Chafetz Chaim explains why it was appropriate in the late 19th century to create a structured school system. He said it used to be that girls, when they grew up, would just learn Torah traditions from their mothers, from their homes, and that was how they were able to learn what they needed to learn. But now girls go out to school, and they go out to secular schools, and they're not picking up the same traditions just being in their home, and they're not necessarily always in their home anyway. And therefore, if we didn't have this type of a structured school system, they would just leave the faith entirely, and that would spell the end to Klal Yisrael, because Klal Yisrael needs both men and women in order to survive, obviously. And that would be a complete disaster, and therefore it's appropriate to have instruction. He spoke about instruction in terms of Torah Shebichtav, in terms of Musar, and he took it that far. And then when there was a question of whether to take it further, that was also something which was only done in consultation with Gedolei Yisrael. That's the notion of Mesorah, like the Nitziv writes that if there are two different Gemaras that talk about that it's appropriate, Olam Yasa Gadam Mitzvah Mitzvah Sapir Shloshma Mitzvah Shemitok Shloshma Balishma, that it's appropriate always to involve oneself in Torah Mitzvahs even if it's not sincere, because the insincerity will lead to sincerity. And then there's another Gemara that says that if you're Osik B'Torah Shloshma Nasi Shlosam HaMavis, then it becomes like some type of poisonous, toxic substance. So what's the distinction? And the Rishonim give different distinctions between the Gemaras, and the Nesiv explains that when you're dealing with just doing the mitzvos that are on the books, So then, even if you do it insincerely, since it's clearly something you're supposed to do, it will only lead to good things. But when it comes to innovations, if innovations are being introduced in an insincere fashion, if they're not being done in accordance with the guidelines and the rules and the parameters and the consultation that is required according to the halacha, so then that could end up being a sam hamavis. So that's also a good indication of how do we know whether something is being done in the right fashion or not? So much of that revolves around the question of, is there proper consultation? Rav Moshe has a separate tshuva. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva in Orach Chaim, I think Chelek Dalet and Memtes, about the tznua hachadasha shel nashim ha'she'ananos ve'hachashuvos, the new movement of nashim she'ananos. It's based on a pasuk in Yeshayahu, the trailblazing women. So he speaks about these trailblazing women who want to volunteer to do more mitzvot and so forth. And Rav Moshe says that if it's being done in a spirit of sincerity, in which it's being done for because chashka nafsha the kayim mitzvot, because she has such a burning desire to do God's will and to come close to the Kaddish Baruch Hu and to keep mitzvot akish shalon itzdakta, even though she hasn't been commanded to do it, so then of course it's all fine and good, and we should even find ways to accommodate it. He speaks about a woman who has a great sincere motivation to wear a talis. He says, well, a talis could be begadish, but maybe we can structure a special kind of talis that would be designed only for women. And he's willing to entertain that notion. He draws the line at tefillin. He says, well, there we have a clear halacha. Women can't wear tefillin. He's very, very clear about that. But he also writes at the same time that it all really depends upon the kavana. That if the kavana is not appropriate, if it's not for the reason that they want to come closer to a Kaddish Baruch Hu, but rather because they feel that the laws of the Torah are insufficient and that we have to effectuate a change in the laws of the Torah, or that the laws of the Torah need to be made more egalitarian, so then he says that then that would not be appropriate because it would not further the Mesorah of the Torah. So everything has to be done, obviously, within the context of the Mesorah. The Chavos Yair, several hundred years ago, was from Germany, was asked about a man who didn't leave behind any sons. He just left behind the daughter, and he asked the daughter to say Kaddish for him. And then when he would pass away. And then the question was whether this was appropriate for a daughter to say Kaddish. And and the Chavos Yair said, well, the whole institution of Kaddish is based on some passage in the Zohar that talks about a child effectuating a schus for the mace. So he didn't see any reason from a strict halachic perspective to differentiate between a son saying Kaddish and a daughter saying Kaddish. But at the same time, the Chavos Yair said, but I am very, very concerned, shel yachlishu minhagi Yisrael, that we shouldn't create a weakening of minhagi Yisrael and a weakening of the Mesorah, that people might misunderstand exactly what's happening as a result of the daughter saying Kaddish. And therefore, he would not allow halacha l'maise for the daughter to say Kaddish. However, he opened up though for a discussion in the event that there wouldn't necessarily be the same concern about yaklashu koach haminhagim, if it could be done in a fashion in which it would strengthen the fabric of the community. And here, what you find the post-game discussing in a number of different cases, and really is something that requires the very carefully calibrated approach of an expert posek, is balancing on the one hand, the concern about shlo yaklashu koach haminhagim b'Yisrael, and on the other hand, to the concern that if something perhaps can be within the realm of legitimacy, and we don't allow it, then that could really drive a wedge and drive people away who might otherwise really become stellar, full-fledged members of the community who would continue to grow in Torah and Yirah Shemayim and build families with Torah and Yirah Shemayim. So this was something that was very much on the mind of Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin in the 20th century. As you know, Rav Henkin was really the preeminent posek in America in the mid-20th century prior to the advent of Rav Moshe Feinstein. And Rav Henkin published an article in the Hapardes Journal in which he said, well, again, Kaddish is supposed to be a schus for the Nefter of whoever passed away, any other who wanted to say Kaddish. So he said, you know what would be the greatest schus? So he said, if we're talking about a daughter who is really creating what would be the greatest schus for her father in terms of acting in the fashion of Benos Yisrael, in a fashion of Tznius and Tara, in her dress, in her demeanor, in her speech, in her shmiras mitzvos, so then we can countenance the possibility that such a person should be encouraged to continue to be a member of the community who is acting in this appropriate and in this laudable fashion by allowing her to express her need to say Kaddish, as long as it's done in a fashion of tznius. And the way in which he considered it, he said, well, maybe if you have a woman who satisfies all of these criteria of Tara tznius, the takos loma kaddish b'fnei hanashim, and she wants to say kaddish in the women's section, b'zman she'omim kaddish b'esek neseh shel hanashim, at the time that the men are saying kaddish in the men's section. So he ends with these three words. If you're a posik, you have to understand what words are going to lead to conclusions that you have absolutely matured something for all of eternity. So he said those magical words, which is Epsher she'en kepeda. Maybe it's not so bad. So based on this Epsher she'en kepeda, this became normative practice, of course. So Rav Henkin's idea that under those perfect set of circumstances, you have a man anyway saying Kaddish in the men's section while the woman's going to be saying it in the women's section, and she's dressed and comporting herself in an open of tznius and so forth. So then that was something which he said could potentially be countenanced. But again, remember, this came from the Gadol HaDor. Even Rav Henkin's psak was not universally embraced. It was much critiqued. There's an essay in the Sheiris Yosef by the late Rosh Shlomo Woman Zatzal, who is of course a very close talmid of Rav Eliezer Silver, and Woman said that he was concerned about Koalisha, and also even the Chavos Das, the Chavos Yair, when he said that Meikar Adin, it's okay, he was not necessarily completely agreed with by everybody else. The Matzei Ephraim disagreed with him. The Geshem HaChaim drew a distinction between a young underage girl below Bas Mitzvah saying Kaddish, which could sometimes be allowed, and a woman who is older saying Kaddish, which he said should not be allowed. And also there was a concern that Kaddish is something which is part of a Darash of Kedusha, and a woman can't be part of a minyan, so therefore how could she possibly say Kaddish? And he was also worried about the slippery slope that maybe from Kaddish would come other types of agendas that would be completely anti-halachic in nature, so therefore not everybody went along with it. On the other hand, since Rav Henkin was comfortable with it, you will find shuls that follow the Rav Henkin approach in which they will allow a woman to say Kaddish if a man saying Kaddish at the same time. All of this could be done as long as there is this appropriate halachic process that carefully thinks through all of these considerations. Number one, what's permissible according to halacha? Number two, what's in accordance with the Mesorah that it won't be machlish the koach of Hamin Hagim, and instead will strengthen the Benos Yisrael who are really, really sincere and lead to greater Torah v'yira Shemayim. And number three, that it has to be done, obviously, in consultation with Gedolim. I saw somebody had their hand up.
Was Rav Henkin assuming that she wouldn't be the one with Saint Kaddish?
Rav Henkin seemed to say at the same time the Kaddish said by men in the men's section. That's the clear indication. I think there's another place where Rav Henkin writes about it as well, but this is the main place that gets cited. Yes, okay. Similarly, if you look in Rav Aaron Soloveitchik has a little sefer on Hilchos Avelus, it's called Od Yosef Yisrael B'Nichai, and in that sefer, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik similarly writes if you have a situation, he said, I could see both sides of the argument, but whether it's appropriate for a woman to say Kaddish or for a woman not to say Kaddish. On the other hand, he says, if yimnu osam beopen she'ayidezeh yisrav ashkanas reformim, if the fact that you're going to prevent a woman from saying Kaddish is going to cause her to leave orthodoxy and to leave a lifestyle of Torah mitzvos, and she's just going to become non-observant, then also linoa bas milomar kaddish. Then he uses even stronger language, and he says then it's absolutely prohibited to prevent a sincere young woman who wants to say kaddish from saying kaddish. So this is a very, very difficult cheshbon. But this is the balance that many of the poskim struggled with. It was similarly struggled with in the context of bas mitzvah, where Rav Moshe was asked whether it's appropriate to have bas mitzvah celebrations. Now here, for sure, you have the consideration of Misorah that comes into the picture, because in the Sephardic community, there was never really any question mark about this, because the Sephardim for hundreds of years had already welcomed the notion of bas mitzvah celebrations when a girl becomes bat mitzvah to celebrate, and now she's obligated to perform mitzvahs the same way that they celebrated bar mitzvah celebrations for boys. There was more of a concern in the Ashkenazic community because the idea of bas mitzvah celebrations, at least in America or in other places where there were Ashkenazic communities, was something that was introduced by non-Orthodox forces. I think that bat mitzvah celebrations are sometimes credited to Mordechai Kaplan, who I think at one time attended this yeshiva. I don't know if I'm supposed to say that, but you know, sort of a gifter. And Rav Chaim Pinchas Scheiberg. I think that, you know, we Baruch Hashem, we have many, many Haredi Rabbanim who came from this institution. But the question about bat mitzvahs was really whether this was viewed as an accommodation to the non-Orthodox movement, or whether it was something which would reinforce halakhic observance. So Rav Moshe's approach was, Ala Rishonim Anu Mitztarim, I don't like bar mitzvah celebrations. That there was a time in this country, I think it's gotten a lot better in many communities, when bar mitzvah celebrations were not full of kedusha vitara. They weren't necessarily the holiest events in the way in which they were conducted. I think it's gotten better. So Rav Moshe said, I think that the bar mitzvah celebrations don't encourage Yiras Shemayim so much, and it would be terrible if we had bat mitzvah celebrations like that. And he also felt that this was coming from reform camp and the like. There's a famous tshuva of David Zvi Hoffman in which he said that if you're imitating the ways of the non-observant Jews, that's also in the realm of chukosehem lo seleich, also almost like a chukas goyim type of a prohibition. So therefore, he said, you want to make a birthday party, make a birthday party, but nothing else. Now, the Sri Deyesh of Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg had a different approach. He said, look, nishtanu adoros. He said, we know that v'chinuch habanos, there are certain innovations that we have allowed that are within appropriate halakhic parameters. Like, for example, the creation of the Beis Yaakov school system. He said, that itself, let's face it, it is an innovation. It's within halakhic parameters, but at the same time, it's an innovation. Sometimes you have to allow for certain innovations for the sake of chizuk hadas. So he said, so therefore, maybe it's appropriate then to allow for bat mitzvah celebrations, but to do make sure that you only do it in a fashion of kedusha, you only do it in a fashion of holiness. So for example, you should make sure that the rav of the Beis HaKnesses gives a drasha, that it's not just some sort of a disco party, that it's the that you have divrei Torah and you have shmiros v'sishpachos. And he says that it all depends upon the kavanah in which it's done. But if it's done to show the girl, this young girl, who's now becoming a young lady, that it's such a special and beautiful thing to become a Bas Yisrael and to observe mitzvos and to live a life of Torah observance, so then he said, then of course it can be a very, very good thing. So it's very interesting. He then said, but I agree with Ramosha, it said, you make a party, make it like a birthday party in the home. He said, I agree, it shouldn't be in the Beis HaKnesses. But even at the same time, in the same paragraph, where he says, I agree, it shouldn't be in the Beis HaKnesses, he says, yes, so just make it like in the social hall. Now, for many people, Beis HaKnesses, social hall, really means the same thing, that you know, would think, don't make it in the Beis HaKnesses means don't make it in the building altogether, but you never have a problem making it in the building. He said, you can make it in the social hall, just don't make it into a ritual affair, in which you're making it into the putting in the Beis HaKnesses itself, because you put it there, so then it bespeaks the possibility that you're furthering a different agenda, a potential agenda of egalitarianism. That's what Meir Tversky Shlita speaks about a lot, that one has to look very, very closely about the way things are done to make sure that it's not furthering some type of an anti-halakhic agenda. So he writes that it's extremely important that if there would be a bat mitzvah celebration, that it not be done in exactly the same fashion as a bar mitzvah celebration, because then it appears that it's not just a fashion of encouraging the young lady in terms of observance of Torah mitzvos, but sending the message that you're just like men. There's no distinction in halacha between men's obligations, women's obligations, men's roles and women's roles. The reality is not that way. There are distinctions. There are distinctions in the nature of who gets counted for a minyan, doesn't get counted in a minyan, who's obligated, Mr. Sessi, she has mine, grandma, and who's not. And even in terms of the desirability of assuming public roles, as we mentioned, there are differences, and that has to be part of the education as well. Rav Avadya Yosef, of course, in his tshuva on bas mitzvahs, just because the Sephardic tradition, which is that this was just considered to be a grand event, part of their Mesorah, that we're celebrating with Torah, Divrei Torah, and Zmiros and Sishbachos and so forth. The fact that a girl is coming of the age where she can observe mitzvahs, again, they didn't have, in the Sephardic community, there wasn't the same concern with respect to different types of associations. Rabbi Willig has an interesting pshara in terms of the way in which bat mitzvah celebration should be conducted, in that he writes that, he quotes the Magen Avraham, who says that part of the inyan of the bar mitzvah is that the father is celebrating the fact that he fulfilled his mitzvah of teaching his son Torah, of preparing his son, the age of chinuch. There's an obligation, v'shinantim levanecha, should teach your sons Torah. There isn't the same obligation with respect to daughters. And there's also the second aspect of the celebration, that now the girl has reached the age of mitzvah. So with respect to the part of the celebration that relates to the father, to the parents, so that's something which is only applicable when a boy becomes bar mitzvah, and therefore the notion of parents inviting their friends, that's only something which is applicable to bar mitzvah celebrations and not bat mitzvah celebrations. But the part of the celebration which relates to the girl, that now she's celebrating that she reaches the age of mitzvah, so that, of course, is applicable to both bar mitzvah celebrations and bat mitzvah celebrations, therefore it's perfectly appropriate for her to invite her friends. So bat mitzvah celebration then is reflected through the presence of the girl's friends and close family members, while a bar mitzvah celebration is something which is a celebration both for the girl and for the parents, and therefore that's one which is larger in nature in terms of the invitation list of being both, of including both the boy's friends and also all of the parents' friends. So that's one way in which he distinguishes, also based on this lumdus. But the importance of the lumdus is that it's halakhically based, and it's very, very important that the way in which we think about how we're going to plan all of these events be halakhically based, so that this ensures that we're doing it in a fashion in which we are appropriately following our Mesorah. Now, the other issue that is very, very out there, I suppose, is this issue of women's leadership roles in terms of the rabbinic community. Can a woman be a rabbi? I mean, we'll say it. It's something which is a subject of discussion. What other types of roles, other types of internship roles, or other types of spiritual leadership roles, is there anything? What about yotzot halacha? How do all of these things kind of, you know, fall into the picture? So we mentioned the Gemara in Sota about the presumed prohibition, but we paskin like Rabbi Eliezer. It's a machlokis tanoim, but we paskin like Rabbi Eliezer that a father doesn't teach his daughter Torah. So when the Rambam codifies this, he says, because most of the women will not take it or be edified by the Torah teaching in the right fashion. So we already have one limitation, that it only applies to role, that we see it's not necessarily across the board. Second limitation the Rambam introduces is that it's only with respect to Torah Sheba'al Peh, not Torah Shebichtav. It has to do with the discussion in Sota over there about when is Haschus Megan, when does a woman not suffer from the Sota waters right away, where based on the level of the woman's knowledge, it might be an abuse in terms of her fidelity towards her husband. So that was the reason why tiplus and promiscuity is introduced into the discussion. And a third limitation, which is codified by the Ramah, is that of course it's appropriate for a woman to learn Torah in terms of what she needs to know. There are all kinds of mitzvahs. Women are obligated in all the mitzvahs lo sa'aseh shebe Torah. Women have special mitzvahs that are incumbent upon them, nidachal adlakas aner, and lots of things that women are supposed to do, that women have to learn the halachos, obviously, that are pertinent to women. So there's plenty for women to learn. So on the basis of these limitations, we see that the halacha itself, again, getting back to the built-in flexibility that we sometimes find within the halacha, that the halacha itself already allows for a certain amount of flexibility, a certain amount of exception when it comes to this halacha. The Prisha, in his commentary to the Torah, the Prisha mentions that although a father does not teach his daughter Torah, Shebaal Peh, but if the daughter on her own determines that she is interested in learning and she's lamda le'atzma and she learns on her own, so then in such a case when the woman is learning on her own, it's perfectly permissible and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that whatsoever. Similarly, there's a very fascinating comment in the Torah Tamima, in his commentary, in which the Torah Tamima says that if you have women who are learning on their own, that they have taken upon themselves to learn Torah Sheba'al Peh, so then he says that all of the different pronouncements that are made by Chazal about the pitfalls of teaching Torah to women are not only not applicable, but these women are to be praised and supported and they are to be honored very much in the community. And he quotes from a sefer called Mayan Ganim from Shmuel Elchanan Yaakov HaKarbalti. This goes back several hundreds of years, and he writes that Umama Chachamenu Hamalamed es Bito Torah Kilu Malam de Tiflos Ulai Nemar Kishaam Malamed es Bekanusa. Maybe that's only when she's taught at a very young age, where it's not clear, because the Vardik Yagam Neikal Meikash, that maybe it will go in the wrong direction. Amnam Hanashim Asher Nadav Liban Osan of the Karvel Amalacha. He's borrowing some phrases from the Torah here, in Parshas Truma and Tetzaveh, that the women who are themselves motivated, the Karvel Amalacha, Maleches Hashem, Bitzad Bechirasan, Bitov B'mashu Tov, Hinhema, Hinhena Ta'alena Behar Hashem, or by Yaakov Tishkana B'makom Kacho, Kineshem Ofeis Hena. These women should rise up in the mount of Hashem. They should dwell in a holy place because they are wondrous women. The Chachmei Doron, the Adron, the Hadron, the Sadron, the Chazik Yidei, and the Amotzro saying we should strengthen their hands and we should encourage them because they're women who have a genuine thirst for Torah and they're learning Torah in order to come close to a Kodesh Baruch Hu, that this is a wonderful thing that should be absolutely encouraged. And then the final touch was given by Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik was asked, this goes back over 60 years ago, about whether there should be a Torah Sheba'al Peh curriculum for girls in the yeshiva elementary and high schools. And the Rav says something very, very interesting, also expressing a type of sentiment that we saw in the Sri D'Yesh, that we saw in his brother, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, as well. He said, I expressed my opinion to you, this is writing to Rabbi Leonard Rosenfeld, who was the chairman of the education committee of the Hebrew Institute of Long Island and the director of the Department of Yeshivas of the New York Board of Jewish Education. This is an essay which is reprinted in the book Community Covenant and Commitment. And he says, I expressed my opinion to you long ago that it would be a very regrettable oversight on our part if we were to arrange separate Hebrew courses for girls. Not only is the teaching of Torah Sheba'al Peh to girls permissible, but it is nowadays an absolute imperative. This policy of discrimination between the sexes as to subject matter and method of instruction, which is still advocated by certain groups within our Orthodox community, has contributed greatly to the deterioration and downfall of traditional Judaism. Boys and girls alike should be introduced into the inner halls of Torah Sheba'al Peh. That's a very, very bold statement that was made by Rav Soloveitchik. If any of us made it today, we get into trouble. But Rav made it 60 years ago. And the Rav's feeling was, as was explained also by members of his family, Rav Lichtenstein has spoken, Zatzal spoke about it, Yibad Lechai, Rav Twersky has spoken about it, was that just as the Ramah spoke about how it's incumbent for a woman to learn those mitzvot that are obligatory upon her, so too nowadays, it be based on the exposure of both of boys and girls to the larger world of secular education and the secular universe. If a girl going to school does not receive the same type of in-depth education and instruction that she receives in other areas of education or in other areas of life, then she might not appreciate the richness and the fullness of a Torah law or a Torah lifestyle. And therefore, in order for her to be able to fully develop her Yiras Shamayim, it's become necessary in the modern age for women to be instructed more and more along the same types of lines of education as the young men who are going to school, even if the education is not necessarily identical, but the notion of being exposed to Torah Sheba'al Peh, certainly having access to Torah Sheba'al Peh, is something very important in the modern age as women become more educated, for them to fully realize the Yiras Shamayim, their attachment to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and their commitment towards living Torah lives and their appreciation of raising Torah families, which is of course absolutely essential to the continuation of the Torah community. It's probably for the same reason that our yeshiva has supported a high school Bikiyas program, which is participated in by lots of high schools, both of men's high schools and women's high schools, where they learn material and they're tested on Gemara, and the yeshiva gives out prizes and certificates towards the top finishers in that competition, both men and women. When I was dean of the yeshiva, I remember signing these certificates, you know, in my office. So it's along the same spirit of this approach that was taken by Rav Soloveitchik. Yes, we have time for a couple of questions.
Does Rav Soloveitchik think that this is like a bit the Evan model, meaning like because the world has changed, therefore we teach them, or does he think it's like even the Chachila language?
It's not, if he meant it as a Bidi Eved model, he didn't use very Bidi Eved language. Yeah. Yes.
In terms of go to Sheba'al Peh for women, should be something that should be always an option for them, or it should be that the school should mandate it?
I think, again, from one thing that you can derive from what the Rav wrote is that the Rav was speaking about a particular community, was speaking about a particular reality. And within the context of that reality, he felt that it would be a big mistake if the women weren't exposed to the same resources of Torah Sheba'al Peh. I think that it probably is important that women have access. The way in which that access is provided is something that can be determined on a case-by-case basis, presumably by different communities, by different schools, and so forth. But the reality of the world in general, the reality that women do have access to higher education, and the reality that all of avenues of knowledge and the complexities of the world around us are much more easily available to pretty much everybody, no matter how sequestered and how insulated they are. I think all of that is very true, and therefore the same way that they have access to everything else in the world, which might not be a very good influence, it's probably not a bad thing to have access to those resources that really could be a very good influence in terms of showing the richness and the beauty and the depth and the nuance of Torah, again, to the extent that this is going to strengthen commitment to Shmiras HaMitzvos and to Yiras Shamayim, which is ultimately the goal that everybody agrees upon when it comes to all of these matters. Okay? Now, at the same time, the question is, how far do you take that? How far do you take this education? A woman becomes a Tamidat Chacham. She becomes very, very learned. So what does she do with that knowledge? Does a woman have the right to paskin, for example? So here, there's a whole question. It arises to some degree from a number of places where Tosfos asked the question, how could Devorah have been a Shofetis? So let's step back for a moment. Can a woman serve as a dayan? So here we have a very clear limitation that a woman can't serve as a dayan. Isha psula ladun, that we have a pasuk, v'amdu shnei hanashim asher lehem ariv v'pnei Hashem, shnei hanashim, below nashim, woman can't be an aid, and there's the principle called apostle oi, apostle ladun. Somebody can't be an aid, they can't be a dayan. We have a sefer gzeiras hakasuv that the Yerushalmi has that derives directly that a woman can't be a dayan. Bottom line, the Shulchan Aruch paskins that shapsula ladun, a woman can't be a dayan. Rabbi Kiva Eger goes so far as to say, even for hataras nedarim, where we're usually a little bit more flexible, a woman can't be a dayan because she's mufka, she's completely removed from the area of serving as a dayan. So dayanus, we know, is off limits. And Tosas asks the question, well, how could Devara, we just read the Haftorah about Devara this past week, how could Devara have been a shofetis? So Tosas answers the question in a variety of ways. One of the answers is that she wasn't a shofetis, but she was melamedis lehem dinim shiyadunu, kadei shiyadunu. She taught dinim, she was very learned, and she taught halachos to the ones who were dayanim so that they would be able to paskin cases. So on this basis, the Pisrei Tshuva and Shulchan Aruch quotes the Birkei Yosef, the Chida, as saying that a learned woman does have the ability to do horah. She has the ability to provide instruction when it comes to horah. The Sefer HaChinuch seems to follow the same approach. This is the Lashon of the Pisrei Tshuva. Says that Isha Chachma Yechola Lahoros Hora'ah, and he points out that the Sefer HaChinuch seems to say the same thing, because when the Sefer HaChinuch talks about the prohibition of giving Hora'ah, of providing for Psak when one is drunk, so he applies this halacha that even a woman who is drunk is not allowed to paskin. So the clear implication of the Sefer HaChinuch is that if she's not drunk, then she would be allowed to paskin. So we see that there is some sort of a range where a woman has the ability to even to provide horah. Now there is a Shari Tshuva that the Pisrei Tshuva quotes that seems to suggest that maybe this is what the meaning is, that we ask women who are familiar with mitzias of things, that they have experience looking at simani trefas and chickens to identify what's a simon trefa, what's not, and then but the psak is ultimately in the hands of a rav and she's not really paskining on anything. However, the simple reading of the chidah, the simple reading of the sefer HaChinuch would certainly give a woman that prerogative if she was a learned woman. But what would be the context of that? So this goes back to the issues of srara. So the Rashi al HaChumash at the end of Parshas Noach speaks about Sarah being a Lashon Sarah, that Sarah, the wife of Abraham, had some type of a Sarah. When we speak about Sarah for women, what does that mean when we say that Sarah is really not applicable to women? So I think everybody would agree that within the realm of the woman's domain, certainly where everyone agrees, where a woman's a keres habayis, she's raising a home, she's raising a family, the notion if you had a learned woman, like give an example, the Rav's mother, an incredibly learned woman and other members of the Rav's family, that to ask a question in halacha, where it was known that that a particular woman had a tremendous knowledge and a tremendous expertise in halacha, to guide her family, to guide those close to her, to say, this is what you do, this is the bracha that you make, this is what you can and can't do on Shabbos, this is what's kosher, this is what's not kosher, that all would clearly fall within the realm of what the Chidah is saying, would make perfect sense and be perfectly permissible. But when it's in the context of a public position, that already becomes more problematic in terms of it being in the context of having an official portfolio. That's where it becomes either an issue or Svara becomes a position of misima. So how does then being a rabbi or being a yoetz at halacha, how does it fall into this model? So being a rabbi has a number of clear problems. Number one, the Rambam writes that the whole idea of smicha, of calling somebody Rebbe, rabbi, the Rambam uses that lashon in Hilchos Sanhedrin, is really intended to be a continuation of the institution of dayanus, that we need dayanim to paskin. So nowadays, how do dayanim function? They function, Tosus explains, as an extension of shlichus de kamaika of dinam, the agents of the previous dayanim. That's what rabbis of today essentially are functioning as the continuing successors of the original dayanim, and therefore for anybody for whom dayanus is off limits, so smicha would be off limits. Any kind of rabbinical position, whether you call it rabbi, whether you call it rabba, but where it's clearly intended to serve in the place of being rabbi, so that would be off limits simply because Dayanus is off limits for women. And the being rabbi has, the smicha has other complications as well in terms of Sraria implications. Certainly, as the Aruch HaShulchan writes, that one of the primary goals of smicha is to equip somebody to be a communal rav. To be a communal rav is very likely a position of Sraria, certainly a position of public appointment. To be in that type of public role clearly has a very problematic connotations in terms of the structure of men's and women's roles within Klal Yisrael. However, the position of rabbi itself is largely a distraction, because I think that it's unquestionable that being rabbi is off limits to a woman, but it doesn't mean that the other positions or certain other positions are unthinkable. So in the realm of Yotzot Halakha, we have to figure out how does that potentially, you know, fit into the puzzle. So there, the idea is that we have sort of a private, one could even call it a tznius realm, of helping women follow Taras HaMishpacha more carefully and more scrupulously, where one could fashion an argument that there would be women, for appropriate tznius reasons, who might be uncomfortable discussing certain things with men, with male rabbinic figures and the like, where if there was a female liaison that they could speak to, then that might be something that could be of value, certainly in different communities. But it's something, again, that would have to be done in consultation with the Gedolei Hador, and it's something which would have to be done in a fashion in which, as Rav Moshe writes, in order to at least reckon with the Shita of the Rambam, that there would be a rabbinic figure, there would be a Rav, who would be supervising the process, who would be supervising this position, so that this position would not be an authority position per se, but just a way of helping to encourage women to increase their Shmira of Taras HaMishpacha. But even here, it's so important that there not be any kind of confusion regarding all of the nuances, because every single aspect of any position really requires very careful consideration. So one question that I, for example, had with respect to the whole Yoaser Halacha issue was that I knew Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was somebody who had been supportive of this position. But I was unclear on the following question. There's a very strong tradition. You look in the Gemara in Brachos on Daf Dalet, the Gemara in Nida, Daf Chof, very strong tradition that even learned women, because the Gemara there even discusses women we know who are learned, Bruvia, Yalta, etc., women like that, were not checking on maros, on the actual stains that would be on a woman's garment. They were always viewed by the men. David HaMelech himself was up to his knees in the blood from the placentas and afterbirths of women in order to, you know, check everything for Hilchos Nida purposes. So we see that there seemed to be a very strong tradition that, and this is not something, this is also just part of Mesorah, that the paskinning on these types of maros was always done by men. It was always done by rabbinic figures. So I asked Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, I visited him the last summer of his life. I didn't know at the time, obviously, that he was about to be Nifter. And we had a very, very enlightening session together. It was really a very, very beautiful session. And during that time, I asked him this question. I said, given that there were all these Gemaras that indicate that it was strictly the male rabbinic figures that were paskening on maros, is it something that you feel that is within the province of Yoatzot Halacha, given the various shitos that indicate that a learned woman can paskin on things? So Rav Aaron Lichtenstein answered me very interestingly. He said that he knows the women who have gone into this particular field, and at least the women whom he knows are, without any question, all Yireas Shemayim, all incredibly God-fearing, and are incredibly sincere. And then he said, therefore, it's inconceivable to me that they would paskin on a mara without showing it to a rav. So Rav Aaron was not one to give yes or no answers, but I thought this answer was pretty, pretty clear. In other words, that we can't go and draw conclusions on our own just because we see that there was support of a particular gadol for a particular movement, that therefore anything goes. Everything has certain parameters, and it's very important to be in constant consultation in order to define and to redefine those parameters, particularly when we're speaking about things that are innovative and different in nature, just to make sure that we do things properly in terms of the Sroa considerations, in terms of the Misora considerations, in terms of the Tznius considerations, and so forth, to make sure that we really are furthering the purpose of the Misora, furthering the purpose of maintaining, sustaining, and furthering Shmiras HaTorah and Yiras Shamayim. And when dealing with other types of models of positions as well, it's very, very difficult to talk about an objective halacha with respect to this job title, that job title, v'kehena v'kehena rabos, and all kinds of different job titles. I think that in any given case, one would have to look very, very carefully at all of these different nuances and in all of these different considerations. Is there a Svara concern? Is there a Tznius concern? Is there a Masara concern? Is the role, a type of role, for example, where it makes sense to take a learned woman and to put her in a certain position in order to provide instruction for women in a particular domain where they might not otherwise have their needs fulfilled, and where there's a Rav who's properly supervising the process? So these are important questions that need to be asked. If there's any type of role, and this is, you know, I recently wrote an article on this subject, and in order to be, and I included it in the materials, but in order to be faithful even to the framework which I am presenting to you, is very, very important to me that I not publish this, and I even sent it to you in draft form, you know, not for publication at this time. I'm still going to work on the article. It's very important to me to show it to my Rebbeim, to make sure that there's a comfortable with the way in which I'm articulating and framing and presenting the issue. So I showed it to Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, Shlita. I showed it to Rav Mordechai Willick Shlita. I showed it to Rav Herschel Schechter Shlita. And the first two of those Rebbeim gave me their blessing. Rav Schechter gave me some comments this morning, but didn't touch my maskanos. He, you know, was comfortable with the maskanos of the article. Little bit of discussion about, I have an anecdote about Professor Nechama Leibowitz. I have to make sure I get the facts exactly right in terms of how I present that particular anecdote about her. But I'm going to try to incorporate his various other ha'aros as well. But one of the points that I made was that I felt that from a Tznius perspective, to create any type of a rabbinic leader, of a leadership role, not rabbinic, but leadership role within our religious community for a woman, in which it's a leadership role over men and women, so that from the various sources appears to just be not in consonance with our tradition of Tznius, and something which I think we have to avoid. But notions of having appropriate roles where women are strengthened in terms of their Talmud Torah, where women are strengthened in terms of their ability to contribute to the community, and in which they're strengthened in terms of their commitment to continue to guide us as the leaders of our families, to keep Klal Yisrael strong. So I think that's, you know, something that we should always support. And just like the Gemara in Sotah says, because of the righteous women at the time of our exodus from Egypt, that we were able to be zocha to leave Egypt. So it's this klus nashim sitkanios that we always have to speak to them, consult with them, and understand their needs, that we'll be able to ultimately guide our communities towards the gula shleima mehera v'yamin.
We have a mitzvah here.